I am J.A. Lovelock, a barrister and an author, but most importantly, a crime junkie. Welcome to my podcast, Behind the Yellow Tape. In this episode of Behind the Yellow Tape, my guest is Simon Corbin. Simon is a lecturer in journalism and creative writing. He's also a crime writer. Listen as I catch up with him to find out more about that.
Yeah, I've always wanted to be a novelist from a very early age. Won a prize at school for English, and I was presented with my prize, a chess set, at the age of 10 by Jilly Cooper, novelist.
Oh, brilliant.
Was it a school competition? How did that come about?
It was at the annual school fete, and we were basically given prizes for coming top that year in whatever subject. It was never going to be maths in my case, but English, I was a bit better at that.
So, well, just think, it could have gone into a completely different direction, like an astronaut or a scientist of some sort.
Well, there's some appeal for chemistry, but I think I better stick with writing now. I think I missed the boat. but Jilly Cooper gave me the prize, and really since that time, I've thought I would like to write novels, and that is what I would like to do. But I began really as a journalist and a copywriter, just to earn my corn, try and live by writing. And also it was a good grounding, because you're writing across so many different subjects for different audiences with tight deadlines, and you become quite disciplined. So it was a good grounding. But I like to see myself as a novelist, and there are 4 books out now on Amazon.
Did you have any training to be a journalist, or was it something that just came naturally to you?
I just picked up the phone one day and called people up and said, I am a freelance journalist. I'm doing a feature for a magazine, and started that way. No formal qualifications were needed then, nor are they needed now. You can do the NCTJ qualification, National Council for Training of Journalists, and others are available, and those are very good. Very useful, but there's nothing to stop you. There's nothing to stop you if you have the gumption and the desire, just picking up pen and paper, although that's aging me, isn't it, that reference. But nothing to stop you just jumping straight in.
Did you work for newspapers, or did you just really started off as a freelancer?
I began as a freelancer. In fact, my first ever job was for Fleet Street, because Ooh. The first features were for a little newspaper called the City of London and Docklands Times, and the offices were above a tobacconist in Fleet Street. So I can say with no word of a lie that I began my career as a Fleet Street journalist.
Yeah, I mean, how do you follow that?
But it was most definitely freelancing, and then freelancing for magazines and newspapers, and then copywriting as well.
Yeah, I had a stint working for a newspaper, actually. And like you, I didn't have any journalism training. What I did was I called up a local newspaper and I said, can I come and spend a day with you and just see what you do? Because I had a feeling that that was the direction I wanted to go into at that point in my life. And so I went down, I spent the day with them, and I'm sitting there. And then I said, can I write something? Because I was just sitting there looking at everybody else. And the editor said, yes, okay, yes, come write something. And I said, will you publish it? And he says, well, if it's any good, yeah, we'll put it in the paper. So I wrote, I think it was 3 pieces I wrote. And it was good enough to get into the paper, into the edition. And then I had what was called at the time a very good job in teaching and training. Mm-hmm. But he liked my work so much, he persuaded me to give up my good job and to come and work as a newspaper reporter, where I was getting absolutely nothing. So I had no training, I had no nothing, and I had no money. But I did. I took a plunge and I did. And it was one of the best experiences that I ever had.
That's good to hear. That's how it works. You start calling them, but then you reach a point where they're calling you. And that's the good part. You
turn the call. Nobody's ever called me since.
It can still happen, Joanna.
Now, I've read that you wrote across, or you write across a variety of styles, a myriad of subjects, and diverse readership. Tell us what that means.
That began in the journalism days and in the copywriting days when, you know, as a kind of jobbing journalist and freelancer, you had to be a jack of all trades and explain things to the readership that were of a great, you know, variety. So I could be writing on factoring in the finance sector one day and then writing about the future of the internal combustion engine for a car magazine the next day. So I had to ensure that I understood all of these different things and then wrote according to the readership of the particular publication, the magazine or the newspaper, and then ensure that what I was writing was, you know, both accurate, which is important for a journalist, be in the style of the readership, the magazine or newspaper house style, as they used to call it. And it was a good grounding. It was a good grounding for, as I say, adapting what I write for different audiences. But it translated into novels simply in a weird way that it's hard to explain, that it came from the ether, in that when I finish one novel, or I'm close to finishing it, it's fully formed into my mind out of nowhere. And more often than not, it's in a completely different genre than the novel I was just writing. So I've ended up with four very different books, and probably that's likely to continue.
So you have written some crime novels.
Yeah.
How did you get into crime?
Crime is, it's quite central. It's central in two of the books that are completed, and in the one that I'm working on at present. But it was more that the topic was there within the subject matter rather than I am setting out to write a crime genre novel. So one of my novels is called Love, Good and Enslin, and it's about the Baader-Meinhof gang and about asking the question, what would happen if Baader-Meinhof was still operating in the world of today's global capitalism. So in order to write that book, I had to do a lot of research into Baader-Meinhof, about 4 years of research as it happened. And of course, they were involved in criminal enterprises to a great extent. So that became my first really experience of dipping my toe into crime writing, but it was very much staying true to the historical reality of it. Then I wrote more recently Black Dog, my crime and supernatural novel. It fuses the two genres, and it's a question whether that book is more supernatural or more crime, because it's a whodunit and a police procedural. So the reader needs to ask themselves, who might have killed this unfortunate girl who is murdered at the beginning of the book. There's a supernatural layer over that. But I was able to be more free with that because it's pure fiction, whereas the previous one on Baader-Meinhof stayed true to historical facts. Here I was just making up a crime story from scratch and I had a free rein. But I still like to have some degree of veracity. So I was very fortunate that a professional forensics person actually did me a crime report and sent it to me so that if the murder in my novel had been a real case that she was working on as a forensics officer, this is what she would have thought, this is what she would have concluded, and so on. And I was able to write using that report which did change it a bit.
You mentioned in the first book, did you say it took 4 years of research?
That one did, yes.
How did you conduct that research?
I was doing a lot of it on the internet, dedicated websites and so on. And I thought at one point there'd be a knock on the door from MI5 with all these various radical left-wing websites I had saved down. Yeah. That I was a bit of a concern at one point. Mm. Also correspondence. I was in correspondence with someone who'd written books on Bader Meinhof from a historical perspective and a professor of politics at Swansea University who knew a lot about it and knew some of the people involved. And very distantly, through a friend of a friend, an old journalism connections, I knew somebody who'd been present at the trial for the Baader-Meinhof people before they went to Stammheim prison, who'd been there present actually in the courtroom. So I had a lot of good source material, but that was partly the problem of why it took 4 years, because I had so much material to sift through to try and figure out what do I use for the narrative in the book. Because books can become very dry, or novels can become very dry, if they're just endless kind of research that's regurgitated. You have to know what to leave out and what to do, to keep in for the sake of the story.
So where
do you... I'm getting quicker, by the way. Yeah. We don't all take years these days.
No. So where would you ordinarily, apart from that book, where would you ordinarily get your inspiration from?
Well, as I say, it's a weird process. I don't know if I'm unique in this, but as I said, that oddly, when I finish or I'm close to finishing one novel, the idea for the next one just comes to me fully formed out of nowhere, out of the ether, almost asking to be written. You know, however Sood's Corner pretentious that may sound, that's been the process. For five books and counting. So they end up very different each time. The very first one, Rude Boy, was a rites of passage tale, drink and drugs and teenagers behaving badly in London in the 80s. And that was really my kind of reimagining of Catcher in the Rye for a new generation.
I was going to say, that wasn't you, was it? Was it autobiographical?
Can I plead the fifth?
Yes. Okay. Sorry, go on.
Very different each time. Then it went to Lovegood and Enslin, Baader-Meinhof and political thriller. And then it went to Little Bastard, which is a kind of kitchen sink family drama set in 1977, dark humour. And then Black Dog, which is crime and supernatural genres fused together.
Do you want to tell us a bit about that one?
Black Dog?
Yeah.
Black Dog is it's a story of the detective, Frank Holmes, so-called in tribute, of course, to the great Sherlock, although my detective is H-O-M-E-S. And he's investigating the murder of a schoolgirl, Sally Hawkins, in East Anglia. And as he investigates, he continues to have visions of a ghostly black dog. And of course, it's a problem for him because he can't actually discuss this with anyone or he'll be removed from the case. So question his own sanity. And the longer he keeps quiet about it, the more intense these visions become. And the book, as I say, it was designed to fuse crime and the supernatural together. They're the two most popular genres around on the bookshelves. And it's a whodunit and a police procedural. So you, if you're reading it, you have to try and work out who actually killed Sally Hawkins. But it's also a super uncanny supernatural thriller because you have to work out, is this ghostly black dog real or is it all in the detective's imagination? And the answers to both questions are only revealed at the end. And I'll do no spoilers here.
No, absolutely. But you certainly keep your readers involved. I like that. I like that. Was that crime, that the part of the book, the crime part, was that based on a real story? Was it a real murder?
The crime was pure fiction, but the idea of the ghost, the black dog ghost, is actually based in reality. I have to be careful how I phrase this, whether it's saying the ghost is real. There's a well-documented, put it that way, there's a well-documented ghost dog in East Anglia known as Black Shuck. That has been seen since the time of the Vikings and the Romans ever onwards and is still occasionally glimpsed today. Many references about Shuck exist. So the ghost dog phenomenon is a real thing. And I was living in that area. I was living in King's Lynn and I was working at a school in Hunstanton doing teacher training. And I believe I saw this ghost dog in the rearview mirror of the car I was driving. And I did some research on it with using my old journalism skills. And the significance of what I'd seen then hit home. And at that point, I thought, right, I'm going to use this in a novel. It's too good not to. I'll use it in a story. And it took some time thereafter to come up with the actual story. But that was then the murder investigation. So the murder is pure fiction, but the dog just might be
that's,
real.
That's quite fascinating, isn't it? I wasn't expecting that, actually. I was expecting it to be maybe the other way around.
Ghostly black dog phenomenon is very interesting. I then did a whole load of research into that as well before writing. And it's ghostly black dogs are the most widely seen ghostly phenomenon worldwide.
I didn't know that. I've learned something new today.
And then this country has the highest frequency of sightings as well. And then various regions of the UK have their own particular ghost dog with its own pet name, if that's not too grim a pun. And Black Shuck is the one for East Anglia.
That's really interesting. Thanks for that. Now, my next question is, have you got a favourite crime story or crime book?
Yes, I think that's an easy one for me to answer because my favourite author is James Ellroy. I don't know if you've heard of James, American crime writer. So my favourite genre to read is crime. My favourite writer living today, writing books, is a crime author. And James Ellroy wrote L.A. Confidential, which became the movie with Kim Basinger, and Black Dahlia, which was also a movie. People who probably know James Ellroy most from those two books, L.A. Confidential and Black Dahlia. My favourite book is called The Cold 6000. That would be my favourite one of his, which is about the assassination of JFK. And he weaves a completely fictional narrative around the real events. He's a brilliant, brilliant writer. He really is. And he does a lot of historical research. He does blend fact and fiction. I mean, I think my Bader-Meinhof, Lovegood and Ensslin book was a conscious attempt to write his type of book, if you see what I mean. But I didn't do it half as well. I would recommend everyone to read James Ellroy. And anyone interested in crime, and the fascinating thing about him too, is very sadly, his own mother was murdered when he was a child. She was the victim of what was believed to be a serial killer, and it was an unsolved case. And he understandably became obsessed with this. And then fixated on a real life murder case, the Black Dahlia case in Los Angeles. And when he wrote the book Black Dahlia, he transferred a lot of the feelings about his mother's killing into that book and into that case. And he's done a non-fiction book reinvestigating his mother's cold case, but it sadly is unsolved.
And would you have a favourite crime character?
As far as the characters go, it's probably, do you mean criminal or on the side of the law?
Criminal.
Oh, on the dark side.
Oh, then we can talk about that. We can talk about the other side as well afterwards. Yes.
The go-to would have been Sherlock Holmes, you see. I mean, Sherlock Holmes has to be the epitome of, you know, a detective and detective writing. And as I say, when I wrote Black Dog, I cheekily called my detective Frank Holmes, but without the L in tribute. And of course, Black Dog, Sherlock Holmes, Hound of the Baskervilles, the actual source material, the ghost dog story in Hound of the Baskervilles that Conan Doyle used, is the same one as I used in Black Dog, Black Shuck. So there's a lot of crossover there, and a lot of kind of sly tributes going on. So definitely Sherlock, I would say. You then got to go Moriarty, I think. But a lot of Agatha Christie is great as well.
Patricia Smith. And would you have a favourite weapon of choice that the baddie, the criminal, would use?
Cluedo style now, isn't it? Professor Plum in the billiards room with the lead piping. I'm not so sure about favourite, but I think it's important that it fits the story, it fits the narrative, and then it fits the character. So the next book I'm currently working on, called I Should Be So Lucky, which is set in 1987 and follows the fortunes of a small group of characters through that entire year, does have a murder or perhaps two. Again, no spoilers, but it turns on a major act of criminality towards the end. And I did have to think very carefully about the question you just asked me about how it could be done to be realistic for the characters and so on. So I think in as much as the punishment should fit the crime, the weapon should fit the crime as well. And you want to have it wielded by a person who would be wielding that sort of implement, as it were. But yeah, I think in the Bader Meinhof book, in the Love, Gudrun Enslin book, people were running around with guns and firing guns off, but that's what they were doing in reality. In Black Dog, the unfortunate girl was strangled with a ligature. And in the next one, in order to avoid spoilers, a sharpened blade.
Sharpened blade, right. Yes.
And a blunt instrument.
Right, and a blunt instrument, yes. Okay. Well, listen, what's this about you being a drummer in a punk band?
Yeah, I played drums for quite a long time. I started age about 13. And though I say so myself and one shouldn't, I became reasonably good and played in a number of bands.
Any names that we would recognise? Beatles or the Stones or anything like that?
Well, people did witness this taking place, but in small numbers, although some people might remember dreadfully named bands that you do when you're quite young. The first band was Stolen Property. The next one was the Martial Arts. The one after that that I was probably in longest was Dr. Smack and the Frozen Turkeys. That was largely the punk one. And the final one was Secret Purple Monkeys. And Secret Purple Monkeys had a gig at Centrepoint in London, in Leicester Square, for the homeless. And also in a squat in Vauxhall at the time of the miners' strike in 1984. So these were the heights of our performances and appearances.
I'm just thinking, who came up with these names?
I have to admit to being responsible for Dr. Smack and the Frozen Turkeys. Or at least the guitarist said Dr. Smack and I added on the Frozen Turkeys.
Okay, let's turn back to writing. Talk about your success and challenges, particularly as a crime writer.
Yeah, so that's a very interesting question in terms of, you know, without getting all philosophical, how does one define success? It's an ongoing process and it's obviously different for each individual. To feel that, you know, have you achieved yet what you want to achieve? And do you feel that an individual book is successful if it's right for you? You know, that may be enough. And I think if you're a writer, it's important to some extent that you write for yourself and you write for the work of art that you're producing as much as for an audience or for publication or for commercial reasons. I'm probably going off on a massive tangent when you were expecting a short and sweet answer, but I think it relates to, so when I was doing my journalism and my copywriting, that was very clearly commercial writing. You know, you have a client and they say, here's the brief, this is what we want, can you get us 1,000 words on this by next Wednesday, make sure it suits the style of our readership, our subscribers and so on. Whiz bang, job done. But when you're doing a novel, that's very much, you know, a work of art and it's a personal creation. So I think what you want to do to feel successful at it is to feel you've got that particular book as good as you're ever going to get it. And then you send it out there into the world. And if that happens to be in tune with what's commercial and what people are looking for, then that's a very lucky piece of happenstance. So I would say I feel that each book that I've written is as good as I'm going to get it. And so as good as I want it for it to be out there. So in that sense, each book's been a success. Whether each book's been a success in commercial sales terms is moot. We may still be waiting for that.
Have you got any books that's been on audio, but like audio books? Any of your novels been transcribed to audio?
All of the novels are out as audiobooks on Amazon ACX. Even my non-fiction book, Freelance Success, teaching people how to write copy for newspapers and magazines, that's an audiobook as well. And interestingly enough, Joanna, since you know this awful period of COVID and lockdown, it's the audiobooks that are selling, and they're massively outselling Kindle and paperback, and especially in America, but also now in the UK. Literally 75-80% of sales are now audiobooks.
That's good. And so you have broken into the American market?
Yeah, Black Dog is particularly appreciated stateside for whatever reason, even though it's, you know, set in a quaint parochial part of England as far as they're concerned, you know.
Yeah, but I think the Americans like that, don't they? The Americans like
they
that.
They do. They seem to love it, and good on them.
Simon Corbin sharing with me his crime writing journey and how he fuses folklore with murderous goings-on. Thanks for listening. Join us next time as we go behind the yellow tape. Till then, catch up with more episodes at btytpodcast.com.
"3 AM, the comedy horror podcast that holds weekly gatherings around the campfire. Let me tell you what you're going to get. You're going to hear stories about demonic possessions, prison stabbings, skinwalkers, glitches in the Matrix, cult leaders, missing 411, night marchers, Operation Paperclip, Mesopotamian devil worship, and so many monsters it'll give Kanye West a runaway for his money. Pop and meme culture also aren't off topic. a camp where laughs and scares are constantly competing for first place. We're just a group of friends trying to bust each other's balls, find the best stories, and expand the circle in the process. 3 a.m., the comedy horror podcast, not for the faint or fragile of heart. Let's go.